On RT Radio 1 now, time for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world. On this week's World Report with Sharon Lynch.
Good morning. On today's programme, Tunisia, the main departure point for migrants trying to make it to Europe, and France begins exhuming Nazi soldiers executed by the French resistance. But first we go to Poland, a country which for many years has largely been associated with emigration. But immigration to Poland, not just from neighbouring Ukraine, is increasing. This week, the government passed a bill to hold a referendum on the EU's new migration relocation deal. From Warsaw, Liam Nolan reports.
Outside an immigration office in central Warsaw, a handful of people stand in the shade, taking respite from the 35-degree heat. Lasha, a 29-year-old computer programmer from Georgia, tells me that he's come to renew his work visa. Vaping and drinking a can of Coke, he says he's lived in Poland for almost a year, working for a multinational firm. It's easy for Georgians to get a work visa here, he tells me. Our government has an agreement with Poland. I then speak to a Filipino lady named May. She's 49 and came to Poland last year with 8 other Filipinos to work on a factory line for a cosmetics company. She's smiling because her work permit has just been extended for 3 years, which surprised her. The immigration staff, she says, are very accommodating. Even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Poland issued the highest number of first-time work permits in the European Union to applicants from non-EU countries. The vast majority of those work permits were issued to Ukrainian nationals. And since the start of Russia's war, 1.5 million Ukrainian refugees have settled in Poland and have the same access to the labour market as EU citizens. Last year, 10,000 work visas were issued to Turkish nationals and almost the same number to Indians. About 5,000 visas went to citizens of the Philippines and smaller numbers to citizens of Bangladesh and former Soviet republics like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Poland's ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party is, however, less keen on what it terms illegal migrants, many of whom try to enter Poland via its border with Belarus. This week, the party passed a bill in Parliament which will enable 4 referendum questions to be posed on the same day as the country's parliamentary election in mid-October. 2 of the referendum questions deal with immigration. One question asks voters if they support the admission of thousands of illegal immigrants from the Middle East and Africa in accordance with the forced relocation mechanism imposed by European bureaucracy. It's a reference to the EU's new migration pact, approved by most member states in June, but which Poland and Hungary opposed. Under the deal, member states would accept a set number of relocated migrants from other EU countries, or instead choose to make a solidarity payment. But given that Poland has already accepted such large numbers of Ukrainian refugees, the European Commission has said that it will be exempt from making solidarity payments. Donald Tusk, the leader of the main centrist opposition party, said that the questions are invalid and that the government was using the issue of migrants cynically for its own political gain. The government says that the questions asked are crucial for the security of Poles and Poland. So far this year, 19,000 refugees, mainly from Middle Eastern countries, have attempted to cross into Poland from Belarus, up from 16,000 throughout all of last year. Many of those refugees who manage to cross the border do not stay in Poland and keep heading west, often to Germany. The number of Iraqi, Syrian and Afghan refugees seeking asylum in Poland each year number in the hundreds. In a recent poll by Ipsos, just over 1/3 of Poles said they had feelings of either anxiety or fear towards migrants from Africa, the Middle East or Asia. But a similar number of respondents said that they viewed the same groups of migrants positively. Poland has an ageing population, and Ukrainian nationals alone are unlikely to fill all the gaps needed by Polish employers. With demand for more foreign workers set to continue, the party that forms the next government is going to have to navigate this sensitive issue with the electorate. For World Report, this is Liam Nolan in Warsaw.
Next we go to central France, where archaeologists have begun digging for the remains of dozens of German soldiers said to have been executed by resistance fighters during World War II. It's after a 98-year-old former resistance fighter went public with claims of the killings. From Maymac, Rory Mulholland reports.
On 12th June 1944, two groups of men stood on a mountain near the village of Maymac in the Massif Central. It was just a few days after Allied forces had landed on the beaches of Normandy. The French resistance, bolstered by the D-Day landings, was launching attacks on German forces across occupied France. One of the groups on the Maymac hillside was from the Front Tireur Partisan, a resistance group led by the Communist Party. There were about 30 of them. Opposite stood 46 German soldiers taken prisoner, along with one young French woman accused of collaborating with the Nazis. The partisans lined the Germans up next to the pit they had made them dig, cocked their guns and opened fire. They then covered the mass grave with quicklime and soil. One of the partisans was Edmond Rivet, whose resistance codename was Papillon, or Butterfly. Today he's a sprightly 98 years of age. When I met him in his home in Maymac this week, he told me he'd refused to shoot any of the prisoners. Some suspect he may well have taken part in the massacre, but as he is the only one of the partisan group still alive, we'll have to take his word for it. The Germans had been captured in an attack by the resistance on 7th of June in the nearby town of Toul. They were then marched 50 kilometres to Maymac, where they were held in a barn before the orders came down to execute them. By that time, the German forces had taken revenge for the attack on Toul. They picked out 99 men from the town and hanged them from lampposts or buildings. Edmond Rivet told me that his commander, codenamed Hannibal, wept openly after being ordered to kill the German prisoners, but he said he himself feels no remorse over their slaughter. It was war, he said, noting that the Germans tortured and shot any resistance fighters that they caught. He said his unit had no choice but to execute their captives, as they had nowhere to keep them and the Nazis were scouring the mountains all around them. The mass execution was mentioned in a history book published in 1975, and many Maymac locals were aware of it, but it was clearly not something the resistance was proud of, and it was largely kept quiet. That was until 2019, when Edmond decided to speak out. He stood up at a veterans meeting and said he wanted the incident to be known to the world, that the German soldiers deserved a proper burial. The mayor of Maymac was present at that meeting. He set the ball rolling for a dig to try to locate the bodies, which began this week, after many delays due in part to the COVID pandemic. The dig might have been a discreet affair had it not been for an interview Edmond gave to a local newspaper this year recounting the whole grisly episode. That caught media attention across the world, and on Thursday I was among 50 journalists from France, Germany, the US and the UK who gathered on that same hillside where the Germans were shot dead. We watched as archaeologists and representatives of Germany's VDK War Graves Authority began excavating the ground where the soldiers are believed to be buried. No one knows exactly where the bodies are. Edmond says that he can't identify the spot anymore. There is one major clue, but one that, like much of this story, is shrouded in mystery. In 1969, an 11-year-old boy called André Narelli spotted a group of Germans digging on his family's land on this same hillside. The VDK War Graves Authority has a record of this dig in which 11 bodies were exhumed and given a proper burial, but the expedition beat a hasty retreat before they could dig up all the bodies for reasons that remain unclear, but possibly due to hostility from the locals. Since then, the affair lay dormant until Edmond Rivet decided to speak out about it, possibly to assuage his conscience before he meets his maker. He said that he watched as his comrades shot the prisoners and the French alleged collaborator. There is no record of who she was or of what exactly she was accused of. She was the 13th one to die, Edmond told me, quite matter-of-factly. For World Report, this is Rory Mulholland in Maymac, France.
And finally to Tunisia, a country that has become the main departure point for thousands of migrants trying to reach Europe. From there, Sally Hayden has more.
I'm in a park in the centre of Sfax, a port city on the Tunisian coast that's currently home to hundreds of people. It's sandy, with piles of rubbish dotted around. There are mattresses for those lucky enough to procure one, and pieces of cardboard for those who aren't. Most of the people I meet here are Sudanese. They fled the war which began in April. Some came from Darfur, where they say a new genocide has begun. They describe villages being set on fire, women raped, civilians slaughtered indiscriminately. They say they ran for their lives, embarking on dangerous journeys, which ended up here. Another dangerous part is still to come. Tunisia has become the most common departure point for people trying to cross what is known as the Central Mediterranean Migration Route, the deadliest in the world, according to the United Nations. Around 10 times more people are currently departing from Tunisia compared to neighbouring Libya. That's because in 2017, the EU started supporting mass interceptions off the Libyan coast, with those caught returned to indefinite detention, a policy that has implicated European officials in crimes against humanity. Tunisia is the latest recipient of an EU deal aimed at stopping migration, with officials offering 100 million euros for border management and related activities. The deal has coincided with a crackdown against black Africans, with more than 1,000 reportedly rounded up and abandoned on the Libyan border without food or water. Dozens are said to have died. Still, tens of thousands of people are sleeping rough in Tunis and Sfax, in temperatures sometimes exceeding 40 degrees, as they try to beg or borrow enough money to board boats towards Italy. I met people from Senegal, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Guinea, the Gambia, Liberia, Somalia, and Sierra Leone. They are victims of the world's inequality. They can't access visas, they can't get on planes, and they say they have no other option. They're fleeing a wide range of different situations, from conflict and dictatorships to drought, crushing poverty, corruption, and religious persecution. We think this way is the shortest to Europe. We're not afraid of dying, a Sierra Leonean 24-year-old told me. He studied electrical engineering for 2 years, but said that in Sierra Leone, one of the world's poorest countries, there was no chance of a job. It's just like a gamble, some win, some lose, he said about the journey. If you don't venture something, you can't gain it. So far this year, there have been more than 90,000 arrivals in Italy. Some of that increase has been influenced by a wave of violence and discrimination that Tunisia's President Kais Saied unleashed in February, when he suggested black Africans were part of a criminal plan to change the demographics of the country. Several people I met said they had lived peacefully in Tunisia for years, but Saied's remarks meant they were evicted from their homes, fired from their jobs, and now they want to cross the sea too. A boat journey usually costs between 1,500 and 2,500 dinars, or between 440 and 735 euros. In some cases, Tunisian smugglers take charge, assembling the people and deciding when the boats will go to sea. In others, my interviewees said, people club together and purchase boats themselves, finding someone with sailing or fishing experience to drive us. This is risky. Many drivers have never been on the high seas before. The boats are often small, around 8 meters long, equipped with a 24 to 40 horsepower engine. The Tunisian Coast Guard intercepts around 45% of all boats, according to figures given to me by Matteo Villa, a migration researcher in Italy. Two young Sierra Leonean men I met told me they already tried 4 times, but were caught each time. When they are intercepted, some people are beaten or pepper sprayed, they said. Their money and phones are stolen. If you aren't intercepted, you could die. The numbers are astounding. An average of 11 children have died every week this year while attempting to cross the Central Mediterranean, according to UNICEF last month. More than 22,000 people have died or gone missing on the route since 2014. If the rest of the Mediterranean is included, that jumps to almost 28,000. Those numbers could be a large underestimate. Everyone I spoke to in Tunisia knew there is a chance that they will die, but they said they have no other option. I thought about that. as I stood in a desolate cemetery outside Sfax, in front of lines of cement graves with numbers marked onto them. They were for unidentified bodies, including those found at sea. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Tunisia.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Sharon Lynch, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.